Now, if you were advising a young player on playing number six, what did you regard as the priorities for your position?
I think defensively, probably because that's my best attribute defensively, but I think from the blind side, you know, you have to be able to tackle hard. You have to be able to make those hard hits around the edge of the rucks, around the edge of the moors when you're there, and also be the player that, that can make the cover tackle behind the back line as well. You know, you'd have, again, going into coaching, you'd have defensive roles, both 6, 7 and 8. You know, if you worked it right, it was phenomenal. I would definitely say, you know, tackling, it all sounds like, well, that's what you do in a game of rugby, but there's tackling, then there's aggressive tackling, then there's, you know, the game-stopping tackles that I think predominantly it's a 6, 8 or 7 type of players that make those game-stopping tackles in the game. And then, you know, the ability to have hard yards as well when it's needed carrying the ball. I was never the best ball handlers, which is probably why I just used to keep hold of it and run as hard as I could. But, you know, for me, fitness levels support both those things. You know, if you're not fit, you're not going to make hard tackles. If you're not fit, you're not going to make hard yards carrying the ball. So everything's underpinned by your level of fitness. And the amount of players that I've seen over the years that you think could have been fantastic players but never really committed themselves to the fitness, which kind of meant they gave up when they shouldn't have done.
I guess it changed during your career in that you know, came from the amateur era to the league structure to then full professional rugby. What effect did that have on, you know, how you approach rugby?
It was fantastic. You know, played up until 95, 96 when it turned professional, and you know, your lifestyle was you would train before work, you'd go to work, you'd train after work. You know, you'd play a wet Wednesday in Wales and play a Saturday somewhere else. And then all of a sudden, the game turned professional overnight. And it's like any, the game turned professional, but did the club turn professional? Did they know how to turn professional overnight? You know, did they have people in place that knew how to deal with professionalism? And the guys that were in place were fantastic, but ultimately they didn't come from a professional background. So, you know, we had certainly the first year of professionalism was a kind of suck it and see, really. It was like, well, okay, turn up at 10 in the morning, and you're used to getting up at 6 and training at 6 till 8 and going to work. And then they go, yeah, if you get here for about 10, then we'll do an hour and a half of training. You're professional now, so we better cook your lunch. So all of a sudden you're having, you know, poached chicken and vegetables and salmon and all the best quality food for lunch. Go off and have a massage if you want one, because you had physios here if you felt a little bit sore. Then train in the afternoon, and then generally be on by 4 o'clock. You know, it was like a dream come true. You've gone from 12-hour days to, you know, 2 hours hard intensive training, lunch, massages, chilling out, 2 hours intensive training, then to be home. And, you know, you were getting paid to do what you would have done anyway. So it was superb. It was a pleasure to be involved in that transition. And then year by year, people with professional sporting backgrounds become involved. You know, when the first professional conditioning coach, this guy called Paul Bolson, got involved in the club, and I think his background was bobsleigh background, professional background, and again, all of a sudden you had this guy coming on, and you know, you had to take your heart rate in the morning, you had tablets you had to take during the night, so you'd literally set your alarm 3 o'clock in the morning, wake up, take some amino acid tablets, then try and go back to sleep to be up again, you know. And I suppose that was the first stage where the game had turned professional, the training started to turn professional as well. You know, where these guys come along, they knew all about the human body and the anatomy and how to push it, and they were pushing you, you know, to your the limit really, and you know, again, a lot of players come along, tried it and failed to win, so just because of, you know, the commitment. I always remember a Friday afternoon, and the boxes up there, you used to have to do a 15-minute rowing machine session, and that wasn't just a case of sitting. This was in the summer pre-season training. That wasn't just a case of sitting on and just row for 50. You had targets you had to meet, distances, times, your heart rate had to be at a certain level at all time, and you know, you literally fall off that rowing machine exhausted at the end of it, and that was your end of week session in the pre-season. You know, all of a sudden you're being told to buy a pair of spikes because you're going down to the track doing sprint sessions. Well, going back in the amateur days, if you told a rugby player you need, you know, spikes to go on a athletics track, you think they'd be talking, you know, rubbish. But you know, these guys come along and you're doing plyometrics, you're doing sprint sessions, you know, all those type of things that just completely changed, I suppose, the attitude of the players and the fitness levels of the players.
What was your employment, you know, before the freshman?
Beforehand, I worked for my father in the tyre industry.
Oh, right.
Dad ran a tyre retreading company, Glanville Tyres Limited, for sort of like 20, 30 years. So I was fortunate enough, left school, went into the family business, and then left at, I think I would have been about 25 when the game turned professional.
And you didn't have any problem deciding to become a professional rugby player?
Not really, no. You know, and when you look how many sports are still around that are still to turn professional, there aren't very many.
Yeah.
You know, so again, certainly team sports and ones that have a huge public interest, there's not many sports like that around that are still amateur to turn professional. So to be around in that era, when you had such a prominent sport like rugby, you know, changed to professionalism, it was fantastic. And you know, I had the full support of Dad and the rest of the family saying, look, these opportunities come around once in a lifetime, you've got to go for it.
What was it like at the start, negotiating a contract?
You've obviously spoke to my former agent, Mr. Fred Reed. It's quite ironic. You know, the game turns professional, and all of a sudden, you know, you're going in a room with committee people and chairmen and things like that, and you have them talk about how much you're worth and how much you want to be paid. Well, from my perspective, I've never done that in my life, and I was just very fortunate that Fred and my dad were the best of friends. Fred's background was HR, and he offered to help. And you know, I must admit, people nowadays say that agents can be a pain in the ass, but ultimately they're there to protect the players, because as a player it's very difficult to sit in front of a coach and tell a coach that you're worth this and you're worth that, and it just takes that awkwardness away from the player. And right back then, I was probably one of the first guys to have representation, and to be fortunate enough to have somebody who knew about negotiating contracts and everything like that in Fred Reed. In fact, at the time, you know, I didn't realise quite how lucky I was. You know, now I look back on it, I think, Christ, I was bloody lucky to have somebody like Fred Reed to go in, come out and go, yep, there's your contract, you want to get that signed a bit quick. You know, he got well paid for it, obviously. Had a bottle of whiskey every year at Christmas. And you know, we're still very good friends now. We still meet up and we still play golf all the time, and we still have that banter about, you know, he was the only agent that never got paid anything.
Well, it must have been quite difficult in those early days with everybody feeling their way.
Of course it was. And you know, you either you would go in or your agent would go in and negotiate a contract, and it's like I always said when I finished playing and went into team management and coaching myself, but when you're negotiating a little bit in work, when you're negotiating your salary, you know, my last statement would always be on this side of the table, right, are you happy with that deal? And if the player says yes, or, you know, the member of staff says yes, then that's it. You know, you can't then go out and find out that somebody had £100 more than you and go back in and go, well, now I'm not happy with that. And I suppose that's what everybody had to come to terms with. You know, sometimes it was a bitter pill to swallow. You know, sometimes you know what you're on. And with the best will in the world, when you're negotiating contracts, especially rugby contracts, you know, you negotiate a deal and they go, don't tell anybody. And then you go out and you know, the first people, what do you get then? Well, I can't tell you that. But it always comes out. And, you know, I think, again, that goes back to you have to be comfortable with what you negotiate at the time. And there's no point crying over spilt milk, because if you thought you were worth more, you wouldn't have signed that contract, you know, regardless of what other people might have got. And there was always, when the game first turned professional, there was always quite a bit of resentment, I think, because there was guys coming in from outside of Gloucester that you knew would be on more money than you because they'd come in outside. But I always took the attitude, well, you know, good for them. You know, why should they be persecuted? They've negotiated a better deal than you've negotiated. So, you know, who's the fool, really? And also, there's always that, there was that thought process that, oh, you know, your local players, they took advantage of you. But, you know, if you're sat in a room with them and you agree to a contract, you can't say that you're being taken advantage of because you've agreed to it. And, you know, that's obviously no longer the case now in modern day rugby. But back then, there were a lot of people that kind of resented outside players coming in. Didn't really fuss me, you know, as long as I was happy with what contract I got. I couldn't care what anybody else was on. You know, the important thing was, could I get along with the guy on a rugby pitch more than what he was being paid?
Yeah.